Vladimir Putin is not the ruler he used to be. To be clear, he's been a dictator the whole time, has always found ways to keep his adversaries from posing any real threat to his grip on power. But for a long time, Putin was able to get his way without an old-school reign of terror. He figured out that manipulating public opinion and tolerating at least a thin veneer of independent thought could work just as well to maintain the kind of control he wanted. But increasingly, Putin is setting aside his spin tactics and getting Russians to do what he wants by making them afraid of what will happen if they don't. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Daniel Treisman is professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, and co-author of the book Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century. In his recent essay for Foreign Affairs, titled Putin Unbound, Treisman looks at Putin's shift from spin to fear in light of Russia's relentless campaign to possess and control Ukraine. Daniel, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me.
It seems that few Russians and frankly few Ukrainians would have predicted Vladimir Putin's willingness for the kind of savagery he has unleashed on Ukraine, despite his earlier invasion of Crimea and despite the fact that he's had the power to do this all along. Why were so many people convinced that attacks on civilians and schools and hospitals was somehow not Putin's style until it started happening?
Well, of course, it was completely unexpected to most people because the way he's fought this war has been so extreme. It really reminds one of the 19th century, more even than the 20th century. He's fighting over territory, over land, and using any tactics that can ensure his victory, including committing apparent war crimes. So I think it's no surprise that people were shocked to see that happening in the middle of Europe. But as you mentioned, Vladimir Putin had previously, up until a few years ago, really pioneered and mastered a quite different style of dictatorship, which relied much less on overt violence at home or abroad, and much more on manipulating the beliefs of citizens, manipulating public opinion so that people supported him. And we saw his ratings were extremely high, have been extremely high throughout his more than 20 years in power. So the war in Ukraine really just epitomizes the very sharp shift that he has made in how he governs at home. And we see the connection between increasing use of force in Russia, locking up political prisoners, putting people in jail for 15 years just for calling what he's doing in Ukraine a war, and the very violent way that he's fighting in Ukraine, the aggression itself, but also the total disregard for human rights and the laws of war.
Your book is all about this sort of postmodern twist on authoritarian rule that you've witnessed in many corners of the world. What does it mean to be a spin dictator?
So spin dictators are really the dominant type of authoritarian leaders around today. And they contrast with what we call fear dictators, which were the typical type of autocrats in the 20th century. So if we say the word dictator, most people probably think of maybe Stalin or Hitler or Mao. And those leaders used huge repression, great violence, and very public violence to control their populations. So they killed millions, put millions of political prisoners in labor camps. They imposed pretty much, or at least they tried to impose complete control over the media. They used kind of heavy-handed propaganda, often combined with an official ideology. And they often closed their state borders against both the information flows and travel, both in and out. So it was a very repressive, violent model of isolation and control. But if we look around at authoritarian leaders in the last few decades, as my co-author Sergei Guriev and I did for this book, you see people who look pretty different. You see people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, the late Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Putin in his early years, or someone like Nursultan Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan. These leaders use relatively little violent repression. And when they do, they try to camouflage it as anti-terrorism or something non-political. They pretend to be democratic, and they hold elections, but they just make sure that they always win them. And a big part of that is co-opting the media or, when necessary, censoring to make sure that the messages that the public are getting support their image as competent, democratic, modern leaders.
Did spin dictatorship sort of co-evolve in various corners of the world based on global and social conditions, or was there a kind of original innovator for this?
I think the answer is yes to both of those. There were underlying factors which drove the emergence of spin dictatorship in different places. So I would point to the dramatic modernization and globalization that occurred really since the 1990s. But at the same time, there was one person, one leader, who had really established this kind of model, and to whom many of the subsequent, the people that we call spin dictators, look as a kind of example. And that person is Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. So Lee Kuan Yew believed in a system with very strict order, top-down control, discipline, but he was sophisticated about it. He created a system in which elections were held. His party always won with huge majorities in the parliament, but there were elections. And Lee Kuan Yew really invented some of the techniques that contemporary spin dictators use to disempower potential opposition. For instance, using defamation cases against opposition members to put them out of action, essentially. So especially when the damages set in these defamation cases were very high, these suits essentially made it difficult for opposition politicians to continue in politics. And that was imitated by dictators around the world. So Lee Kuan Yew was a kind of pioneer, and people like, Putin, Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan looked up to him. In fact, both Putin and Nazarbayev gave Lee Kuan Yew a medal. And they sometimes copied his innovations. But it wasn't just that. It was that the conditions in the world as a whole were making it harder and harder to succeed as an old-fashioned fear dictator, repressing the population. That was just incompatible with a world that was moving out of heavy industry into the knowledge economy, and where societies were getting more highly educated, more sophisticated, more unwilling to be completely shut out of politics and more likely to fight back against violent repression.
So what are the benefits to regimes that practice this? If spin dictatorship has never really been motivated by some sincere attempt at kinder, gentler governance and respect for one's own people, do you just yield better results when you do things this way?
Yes, I think if you're trying to control a society which is relatively modern and plugged into international networks, globalized, trading a lot with other countries, exposed to foreign media, then the old strategy of trying to sort of lock the borders and keep everybody in, isolate yourself, and use repression is just less effective, and it has huge economic costs. So the reason, as you suggest, that these dictators look to these softer techniques is not compassion or deep moral conviction or anything like that. It's straightforward self-interest adapting to these new conditions. And what they get out of it is the ability to trade, a certain amount of international respect, or at least respectability, links, foreign direct investment, links with the outside world. And they manage to survive in a world where basically the media has become global and is watching what leaders are doing in their own countries all the time. And at the same time, they're able to motivate the more educated sectors of their society to produce the economic growth that they need in a world where knowledge is so much economically more important than simply, producing things in a factory. So I think that's what they get out of it. And it's a tough tightrope to walk, but if they can do that, clearly there's a potential to succeed far more than using the old techniques. And the great example, of course, is Singapore, which really mastered this model and has done tremendously well, both in economic development and, you could say, in international respectability.
So Vladimir Putin kept himself on that tightrope of spin dictatorship for a long time. I mean, one could argue he was maybe a hybrid spin fear dictator because he did some things that don't really fall into this model. But things were basically spin focused for the Putin regime until about 4 years ago. What was the turning point?
Well, I think it was there were several turning points. It was a progression. First of all, when he came back to the Kremlin as president in 2012. So he'd stepped down because of term limits. And for 4 years, his associate Dmitry Medvedev had been president, and Medvedev had pushed very much the agenda of spin dictatorship. He'd been talking endlessly about modernization, the tech sector, talking about freedom without doing very much, but maintaining relatively good relations with the independent media. Then Putin comes back, and there are mass protests against a falsified election in Moscow in 2011, 2012. And I think this shocks him. And he feels that this model is not as secure as he had thought previously. And from then on, he starts gradually imposing more restrictive policies. But then I think what drives the subsequent evolution to ultimately this quite extreme reliance on intimidation today is the further modernization of society. So we see in the period since 2012, huge increase in internet penetration in Russia, and the embrace of social networks and YouTube. So YouTube becomes, in Russia, becomes YouTube's fifth biggest market.
One of the things that has sort of made things more challenging for Vladimir Putin is that the Russian people, because it's the 21st century and the internet exists, was having a harder time, I guess, selling his own people on his vision of Russia versus the West.
Exactly. And yes, and one symptom and kind of exemplar of this is the rise of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who really mustered YouTube more than any other politician worldwide, perhaps. He achieved a massive audience on YouTube. It started 1 million, it's up to 6.5 million. He started posting these videos exposing the corruption of the Kremlin elite, including a video of the palace that was built for Putin on the Black Sea, supposedly for more than $100 billion. And this got 122 million views. So in this environment, and also with values becoming somewhat more liberal, according to the opinion polls, and people going out to protest, despite increasing repression coming from the police, I think Putin just came to the conclusion that the old strategy was no longer working, and the only way forward, the only secure strategy for him was to go back to massive intimidation, to shutting down the independent media completely, and to scaring people into obedience. And that's what we've really seen increasingly in the last three years, but really it's become the essential policy since the beginning of the war in Ukraine.
Navalny, of course, was poisoned. Presumably, the assumption, the intention was to kill him, but he did survive. Did Putin's people make it clear that he and his supporters were behind that attack? Was he not trying so hard to cover up the fact that he was capable of this kind of thing?
Yes, and the key thing about spin dictators is that when they do use violence, they try to conceal their involvement, their responsibility. So in that respect, even as Putin was ordering a team of FSB agents to go and smear poison into Navalny's clothes, Putin was maintaining that the Kremlin had nothing to do with this and that this was all an invention of the opposition to discredit the government, to discredit him. That's typical. So it's only really when people go completely into the depths of fear dictatorship that they want to scare people, that they want to create this image of brutality and ruthlessness. And Putin has, you know, we've seen throughout his time in power the attempt to maintain this image of a modern, internationally respected democratic politician. And it's only really now that he's sort of accepted that it's just not possible to be, I think perhaps he thinks that the West would never really respect him and would never give up on trying to overthrow him. So he's accepted that his image, even though he continues to deny poisoning Navalny, that his image is going to be one much more of the tough, ruthless leader who is fighting against external enemies to defend Russians rather than this more suave international leader who goes to Davos and appears in all the international summits.
What sort of aggressive stance has the Putin regime taken against particular religious groups within Russia in the past few years?
Well, something that many people don't realize is that there are actually substantially more, far more people in prison because of their religious beliefs than there are political prisoners, explicitly people who are arrested because of their political behavior or participation in protests, that sort of thing. And one of the stranger aspects of this is the repression towards Jehovah's Witnesses. So there are many Jehovah's Witnesses in Russian prisons. Apparently, the impulse for this comes from the Orthodox Christian Church in Russia, which is very intolerant of minority religions or alternative religions. There are also a lot of Muslims in prison who are considered by human rights organizations to be there essentially because of their religion. They're accused by the authorities of participating in extremist Islamist groups, but often there's very little evidence of that. So religion is a kind of odd element in this picture that people don't know so much about, but it's quite significant.
All right, I want to go to the phones. We have Jean on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks, Chris. Your guest actually just teed up my question. I was going to ask that very same question around Putin's influence or the influence of the Orthodox Christian religion on Putin's sort of messianic take around his invasion of Ukraine. And the reason I ask is, originally the thought was because they are aligned religiously, he used that as a justification for invading Ukraine. However, in the media, I'm not hearing that, and you're the first person that I've heard talked about that. So can you expand a little bit more on what you just said around the influence of the Orthodox Christian religion, particularly as it relates to Ukraine? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. So really since 2012 or so, Putin has been trying to project this philosophy, this kind of political philosophy of resistance to the decadence of the West. And so he identifies very strongly with the Russian Orthodox Church. Both the church and Putin in his own rhetoric are frequently attacking, the gender rights, the tolerance of homosexuality in the West, and treating those as really the kind of symbols of decadence in the West. Now, with the war in Ukraine, the Orthodox Christian Church, or at least it's, I shouldn't say the church, the leadership of the church, Patriarch Kirill, has very strongly supported the war and spoken in quite apocalyptic terms about why this war is important. There have been some priests who have spoken out against the war and sometimes taken consequences for that. But the general position of the authorities of the Orthodox Church has been to support the war. It requires a certain amount of kind of far-fetched rationalization. They really have to emphasize and exaggerate and I would say invent this image of the decadent West and the need for a Christian defense against everything bad that's coming from the West. That's very much the direction that Putin has been moving in recent years, and Patriarch Kirill along with him.
I want to talk some more about the Kremlin's control over online communications. What tools does the Putin regime use to limit Russians' access to things on the internet that it finds unacceptable?
Well, in the past, the strategy on the internet, level of control on the internet has been milder than in China, but over time it's increased. But it's combined both the banning of an ever lengthening list of websites, and more recently the banning of the major Western social networks like Facebook and Instagram and so on. It's combined that with a kind of random punishments of people for posting or even recirculating posts, sharing posts online. So some people have been arrested and prosecuted for extremism for things that they did online, for things that they posted online. Control has been tightening, and basically at this point, when the independent media was shut down, obviously their social network and internet presence was also restricted. Now, of course, Russians, as indeed Chinese people, can get around those controls simply by using a VPN. It's possible for people in Russia to get information from outside. The Kremlin has made it harder over time. And there's been rumors that they're about to close down, to ban YouTube in Russia. There's a kind of inferior Russian version that they've been developing called RuTube. So far, they haven't gone that far because I think they realize just how emotionally attached many Russians are to YouTube, and how big a deal that would be, especially for the younger generation, which is much less enthusiastic about the war than the over 50 crowd.
So this could backfire for Putin.
If he were to prohibit YouTube, to ban YouTube, I think, yes, there could be negative reaction. So he would only do that, I think, if he felt that there was no better way to deal with that threat. And as I said earlier, that really has had a big impact on Russian society over the last 10 years. The big spread of social networks, the spread of YouTube, and the use of YouTube by opposition activists like Alexei Navalny, but also by people who are not overtly political, but who build up these very large audiences of 5 million, 10 million, sometimes 20 million. There are Russian rappers who have 20 million people tuning into their clips. And over the last few years, and especially since the war, some of those rappers and social, you could say even celebrity bloggers have come out against the war. So that's one front that Putin has to defend. It's a matter of calculating the balance of costs and benefits. But the costs would be very real if they went ahead and completely disconnected YouTube.
So, Daniel, at the height of his popularity, the Russian people broadly supported Putin's annexation of Crimea. What has the domestic Russian reaction been to the campaign to reclaim the rest of Ukraine in the last few months?
That's a very difficult question to answer well, because we know what the polls say. The polls say that initially about 83% were in favor, or 81%. Now it's down to in the 70s, around 74%, I believe, but overwhelming apparent support. But it's hard to know quite what to make of that, because especially in an environment where you can go to jail for 15 years for even calling what Putin describes as a special military operation, even calling that a war, many people may be nervous about expressing their true opinions, even to pollsters. So, and of course, there's a lot of conformism and rallying behind your country, even among people who are not completely comfortable with what's going on. Add to that the very distorted image of the war that Russians are receiving through state TV and all the mass media. And I think it's hard to fully appreciate just how compelling that kind of extreme propagandistic collage of images can be, just because it's so consistent and detailed and sophisticated from the point of view of propaganda techniques. So I think Russians have been barraged by this information war really coming from the Kremlin. The initial reaction has been strong support for the war, but I think it's softening, and I think it'll soften further, just as support for previous military or militarized or moments of external threats like Crimea, Chechnya, the war in Georgia. Always there's a gradual decline in support. And I think we'll see that as people get more information, as they sort of work through the stage of denial, which I think many are in, because what their troops are actually doing in Ukraine is so difficult for people to accept. And as the economy deteriorates, I think we're going to see more generalized discontent, which will be in part rejection of the war. And on top of that, more and more people are going to become aware of the very large numbers of casualties, and that'll take a toll. So at the moment, there's a kind of, on the surface at least, widespread enthusiasm, support for the war, but I think it's more shallow than it looks, and already beginning to dissipate.
Daniel, how has the makeup of Putin's closest circle of advisors changed in recent years?
That's a very interesting question, because when he started out, he really had three groups of advisors, people that he talked to regularly and that he listened to on different subjects. These were, first of all, economic technocrats, people who are expert on how markets work and so on. And second group was political fixers, political operatives who knew how to manipulate elections and manage the media. And the third group was security service professionals, agents, often people that he'd served with when he was in the KGB, or in any case, people who came from that that world. And so Putin would really consult all three groups and balance them against each other in making policy decisions, leaning more heavily on the group that had expertise in the particular area of focus. So that was how he started. And he stayed like that for a while. But over time, I think he lost faith in the economic specialists, the economic experts, in part because they seemed alarmist to him. They told him that if he locked up a big businessman for 10 years, then the markets would crash. But he arrested Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the entrepreneur who bought the oil company Yukos, and jailed him, and the market soared. Huge increase in price of stocks in the following 2 years. He repeatedly was warned that if he allowed expropriation of companies by his cronies, then, you know, that would be bad for the markets. And nothing happened each time because the price of oil rose and the Russian economy did fine. So I think by about 2012, he really pretty much sidelined the economic specialists and really didn't listen to them that much anymore, except on perhaps a few very narrow issues. And then in the course of the last 10 years, I think he lost faith in the political operatives because of these mass protests, which broke out, first of all, in 2011, 2012, and then later in 2017, 2019. So despite the manipulation, the spin, all these tactics, still people were taking the streets, protesting the government, calling for Putin to step down. And I think really around 2019, he decided simply to hand control over to the security service agents, his close circle of what in Russia are called the siloviki, the force agents, the men of power. And so at this point, and I think in the period before the war, he was listening to a very narrow set of people who basically shared his rather extreme worldview about the clash of civilizations, the threat from the West, the threat from NATO. He had stopped listening to discordant voices, the people who in the past would, you know, bring up other considerations or question some of the reports that he was getting. So we've seen a real evolution. And now, unfortunately, he seems to be very isolated. And the few people that he still trusts and still talks to are the people with the most extreme views.
How does any of what we've talked about so far in this conversation explain why Putin chose to invade Ukraine when he did and in the manner he did?
So I don't think there's a necessary connection between the way he decides to control things domestically and what he does internationally. In fact, spin dictators on average are relatively less bellicose than fear dictators. They more rarely start wars. They more rarely initiate military disputes. But Putin was different in that respect. And I think part of the reason is that he has nuclear weapons, and he likes to remind us that he has nuclear weapons and very powerful missiles. So he has that level of security against existential threats. But I think in part what I was just saying about the narrowing of his circle, that evolution over time, the surrounding himself by people who told him what he wanted to hear and by people who like he did, believe that the West is out to destroy him, to destroy Russia. I think that obviously fed into the decision on Ukraine. And how it's being fought, again, I think he's become very cynical, and having decided that he was no longer going to pretend so much, even at home, that he was a sophisticated, modern, humane type of leader, he was going to use any kind of force, any tactics that would get the job done more quickly. So we've seen this horrific, unrestrained use of torture and abuses of all kinds, seemingly obvious war crimes, just because I think cynically he thinks that'll be more effective at this point.
Is it your sense that Russia will have to prevail over Ukraine for Putin to maintain his grip on power in Russia?
This is very hard to judge, because if we look at the statistics, even among dictators who start a war and lose it, only about 50% fall within the next few years. So the odds certainly go up if you lose a war that you've started. But they only go up to about 50% of being overthrown or forced out of power in some way or other in the next 4 years or so. So I wouldn't say he will necessarily fall if he doesn't win. And there's a broad gray area in which he can present some limited or partial success as being a victory of some kind. He can also continue to use this this campaign against the West, this sense of victimization and national vulnerability to mobilize the public. I think obviously as the Russian economy is strangled by these sanctions, life will get harder for everybody. And it would be natural to see his ratings fall and threats to his command increasing. But those things I've learned from experience are completely unpredictable. We can say that the odds perhaps are going up of the regime melting down in some way, but trying to pinpoint a time when that will happen, or even saying for certain that it will, is just playing against history, and history always seems to win those games.
I'm not a political scientist, of course, but based on what I know about human nature, fear can work really well as a tool of manipulation with adults over a certain age. Young adults, though, just sort of by nature are pretty fearless, right? They feel invincible. They feel entitled and empowered to challenge those older than them on a variety of fronts. Does Putin's shift to fear dictatorship create a new sort of youth problem for him?
Yes, I think it does. I think that's a very important point. And we do see this striking divergence between the opinions of the young and the old. There's a very strong relationship between support for Putin and age. And in part, that may indeed be related to attitudes towards risk, fearlessness, or confidence. I think it's also related to just life prospects. So people on a pension, what they care most about is that their pension continues to be paid. They want to feel secure. And they also, they have a kind of nostalgia, which they don't want to see. They want the past that they lived through to be respected and remembered in the same positive light as they see it in. But the young, they look ahead and they see in Russia the economy deteriorating, the control of these kind of brutal and cynical policemen at the top. They see a country which really has no place for them to develop in unless they go over to the dark side and join the police force or state enterprises and basically make their peace with a kind of brutal and cynical system. So I think in part it's that. It's just that the perspective, the prospect of what's going to happen and what's available to people who are young in Russia, it's very gray. And they want change. They want, if not radical change, at least reforms, which will create new opportunities. And they're also quite international. Their internet penetration has increased dramatically, even among the old. But there's no comparison with, you know, how connected, how online the young generation is. And in part, they're connecting with the outside world. And they want to be part of that. They don't want to be isolated. And that's also, I think, a difference between the elderly and younger generations.
Daniel, in an ideal world, no one would live under the thumb of a dictatorship. But broadly speaking, are individual people better off with a spin dictator in charge than with a fear dictator in charge?
Yeah, I mean, it's sad to say, as you say, nobody wants to live under a dictator. But if you have to choose which type, well, the fear dictators in the past have killed millions of people and done so in an obvious and terrifying way. They've put millions of people in prison camps. The spin dictators, they manipulate, they concentrate all political power in their hands. You know, people are basically, it's in the dictator's interest that people feel secure and they feel relatively good about their society and about their government. So it's certainly not ideal. Democracy is obviously preferable, but I think people can live happier and more secure lives in a spin dictatorship than in a fear one.
If Putin had to choose, is your sense that he would rather his people fear him than love him?
At this point, yes. And earlier on, just the opposite. He managed to make it work for a long time. You know, this strategy of really securing love and not needing the fear. That lasted for a very long time, and his approval ratings are still very high, although there's now, I would say, an element of fear in the approval ratings themselves. But I think he was genuinely extremely popular for a very long time. He chose that. I think it's clear why he did. It's just a much more effective way of managing, if you're determined to control everything, managing a modern society. But now he's gone over to fear, and it's really hard to imagine how he could convince people again that he'd switched back if he chose to do that, that he was finished with all the killing and the political persecution, and that now he was going to be a modern, civilized, democratic leader. So, yeah, now he needs people to fear him, because if they don't, then he will have no security.
Daniel Treisman is professor of political science at UCLA, co-author of the book Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century, and author of a recent essay for Foreign Affairs titled Putin Unbound. Daniel, this has been really interesting. Thanks for making the time to talk with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at the handle KERA Think. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can find it for free where you get your podcast just by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.